Should they score?
This week in the NHL.
I felt like I did all the right things to prepare for this game.
We got to be focused all 60 minutes.
This week in the NHL.
The most arrogant team he's ever played against.
Do you think it's more of a personnel issue or more of a
he's dominating like the Jets wanted him to do.
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve. Now Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, and Richard Pollock on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things hockey. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL This Week with Illegal Curve Hockey. Alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel, and it's unfortunate that the individual who would normally be periscoping this right now is the one having all the trouble, as there's about 400 cords wrapped around in an intricate pattern. Ezzy, you're good?
I have beef with the Big Show or whoever tangled up these headphone cords. I mean, these headphone cords were so tangled up, I actually had to unplug two of them. And it was like, you know, it took me 5 minutes to get the right headphones going on here, but I'm good now. So
I saw Gary tangling all the cords when he saw you. He's like, I'm going to give Ezzy a little puzzle.
And, you know, you managed to make it through the maze there, Mouse Boy. So congratulations and welcome to the program. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com. We start with last night's Jets victory over the Vancouver Canucks, a game where the Jets, we certainly know, were playing out the string at this point in time. It's certainly about pride or whatever. The Canucks entering last night's game talked about, you know, they're still having a faint playoff chance. I think they entered the game last night 6 points out of the final wild card spot. Now, you and I and Ezzy would all say they're done, but they were going through the motions. And so they went through the motions in the pregame skate, and they entered the game, and that was one of the worst efforts I've seen from an opposing team all year long. The Winnipeg Jets were absolutely dominant last night, a 5-2 margin that somehow actually flatters the Vancouver Canucks, even though they lost by 3 goals. Impressive performance by the Winnipeg Jets in a game that, quote-unquote, doesn't mean anything, but just an absolutely horrendous performance by the Vancouver Canucks on the flip side to that.
Well, Drew, you mentioned that the Winnipeg Jets might just be playing for pride here, but, I mean, when these non-playoff teams are going head-to-head, and you're going to see this tomorrow night against the Flames in Calgary, I mean, someone's got to win the hockey game, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, these teams are going to go out there, and they're going to try to win. Players, especially guys that are playing for a roster spot next year, they're going to be busting their buns. So I'm not surprised at the way the Jets played and the fact that they won. I think these last two games, so you're throwing in the Saturday victory over the Colorado Avalanche, I think these two wins have probably been the most impressive wins we've seen from the Jets in maybe the last 2 months. I think they've been playing really well. And when you consider that the Jets went into that game without Brian Little, without Nikolai Ehlers, without Dustin Byfuglien, who's only out short-term, he had the flu, when you consider that they had those three elite players out of the lineup. I mean, Nikolai Ehlers might be a rookie, but I'd still consider him to be an elite player. It was a very impressive victory. You know, the Jets are up 5-0. Sure, the Canucks get a couple of late third period goals, Richie, but I was really impressed with the way they played, and that includes guys on the fourth line like J.C. LaPon and Matt Halaschuk, who were going in the corners and laying body checks. I mean, these are guys that have a slim chance at a roster spot next year. I mean, I would say that, you know, there are other players, especially younger players in the system, that have a better chance. So those guys are really going that extra mile to make an impression on Paul Maurice and the coaching staff. So I think that win on Saturday was a big one against a Colorado Avalanche team who is still right now tied for that last playoff spot. And then the Vancouver Canucks, you mentioned, you know, they were 6 points out of the wild card spot. That's going to be very tough for them, and especially with that loss last night against the Jets, they don't have a shot at making the playoffs.
I mean, that's an awful hockey team.
One, and especially, Richie, if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan, going to watch your team, and the Canucks have played better as of late, I'm not including last night's game, but if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan, you're watching your team, and you're saying, where was the effort level? Where was the passion? Where was the heart? So give the Jets a lot of credit. Give guys like Marco Dano a lot of credit. I thought the defense was really good. Julian Melchiori looked pretty good in his second NHL game. Even though the game might not mean much as far as playoffs go, Drew, they're still going out there and they're giving a good effort and they're trying to win hockey games. So it's really nice to see because there's 13 games left here and the Jets have no shot at making the playoffs. So they might as well go out there and try to win. I realize that
– play spoiler is what you're saying.
Right, and I realize Tank Nation doesn't like to hear that, but that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, I thought they played well yesterday and there's some key parts. I know Drew will talk about that in a second in terms of what you take from games like these. But you know, one thing that I take on a big picture level, and we've talked about this before, the Jets are not as bad as their record is.
Mm-hmm.
And they really shouldn't be where they are.
They're not 5 points worse than Vancouver entering last night.
No, certainly not. And, I mean, their injuries this year haven't been very significant. You have the ones that basically when they were out of it.
Yeah, they all happened the out of it. Yeah.
Like, just to think this is the way the season has gone has to be pretty disappointing. Because your back end's really voided injury, and Mark Stewart's injury has allowed some guys with better mobility to come in and move the puck. And if Pavlik's injury allowed Hellebuck to come up and then prove himself to a certain extent for sure. So you just watched yesterday's game, and the Jets are certainly better than Vancouver. They obviously, as everybody who watched the game knows, they controlled the play throughout. But they're not in the same transition period. Like, Vancouver's 2 years behind the Jets in terms of that. Mm-hmm. And Vancouver hasn't invested fully in the rebuilding project. And by that I mean they still have the Sedins. And unless you can move on the Sedins, you can't go both ways.
Because the Sedins aren't going to sit through a complete rebuild.
No. Well, they might because they want to stay in Vancouver, Drew, but they're going to put up 60 to 70 points doing it, and that doesn't help you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I don't see how that balance is there. And how are you, you know, I know they have, Thatcher Demko, the young goaltender, and they have some pieces. But like, are there pieces at Brock Besser's a player I've seen play once, awfully impressive.
From North Dakota.
Right. But, I mean, the other guys that they have, the Bo Horvats and Jake Virtanens, there's skill there, no doubt. But is it upper echelon skill like the Edmonton Oilers or even, you know, like Calgary? Like you know, teams are going to be playing their division for a bunch, or Arizona. Like Arizona's got a ton of young talent too. So those few teams are going to be battling what they still have. So they still have a way to go. But let's talk about the things, you know, little things we can pick out from yesterday.
Let's start with Alex Burmistrov. He obviously had a good game last night, and you know, getting on the score sheet. You know, lately, you know, there's a lot of talk about you know his play as of recent. You know, maybe with a bit of an expanded role. You know, how do you view Alex Burmistrov's play as of recent, and then conversely, how do you view that entering into next year, which will be a contract season for him?
I think that he has played his best 10-game stretch of his career in Winnipeg. I don't think there's really any doubt about that. Shane Knighty mentioned it yesterday during the game, and I agree. You know, the fact that he's shooting the puck and actually getting that shot off, which seems to have improved certainly from his first time around, but it's hard to tell a lot of the times he doesn't shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
There are still some drawbacks in terms of involving teammates and moving away from the net. I think certain things like that. So you'd have to see how that fits when it's a little bit more competitive. Like it's still there's still an asterisk to me beside everything done now because of the fact that there's no pressure.
Window dressing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's I think you can read something into it, but you have to also take a step back and say, but how much do I read into this? Burmistrov's play has been very good, though, Drew. I don't know. I mean, if you're asking for an elevated top six role, I don't think that's in the cards. I think really what you're figuring out is can he be your third line guy in the middle? Or are you looking at fourth line? And I think right now, the way he's played and his skill level versus Adam Lowry is giving him a shot for sure to come into camp next year. And prove his worth, but it's certainly
prove his worth in the center position.
Yeah, I think so.
And move with Adam Lowry, conceivably moving to the wing or something along those
something
lines.
Something like that. Yeah.
Ezzy, how do you see Alex Burmistrov?
Well, he's certainly been good over the last 3 or 4 weeks, as Richie mentioned, and he's got 4 points in his last 4 games. And that line with Matthew Perreault and Marco Dano was arguably the best line of either team last night in Vancouver. So you got to give Alexander Burmistrov a lot of credit. I think he is responding to the added responsibility that Paul Maurice has given him, but he's had a bad year. He's only got 18 points this year. He hasn't been very impressive. Sure. And I think that even though he might be a reliable defensive forward, I mean, you still got to chip in offensively.
For
I think they were expecting more than 7 goals out of Alexander Burmistrov. So I think he has a lot to prove to the coaching staff. He's under contract for one more year. I don't think he's going anywhere. But I agree with Richie. At this point, he's better suited for a third-line role, arguably a fourth-line role. And I think heading into next year, guys, the Winnipeg Jets are looking pretty solid, you know, in their top six. I mean, Brian Little and Nikolai Ehlers are injured right now, but you've got Blake Wheeler in there, Matthew Perreault, Drew Stafford, probably Marco Dano factors in the top six, possibly. I mean, they'll have to figure it out. It's going to have to be earned, right? There's no – I mean, are they weaker on the left side with the departure of Andrew Ladd? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They're stronger up the middle and on the right wing.
It's funny you mention that, because I was going to say that if anything that I've taken from the last few games, or the last, you know, let's say half a dozen games, is that the bottom six of the Winnipeg Jets is probably going to be better next year than we've seen in the previous few years. The guys who are fringe NHLers, I don't believe are going to be on the roster anymore.
I think it has to be better. It's been very bad this year. I don't think it can go anywhere but up. I think the spots are a little bit more solidified. Like, you know, Brian Little and Mark Scheifele are going to be penciled in as one and two centers. You know, Blake Wheeler is going to be your first line right winger. You know, Drew Stafford is going to be either first line or second line left wing or right wing. He can play both, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's what I meant more so than, you know, is there more room for growth? I mean, we have to talk about Mark Scheifele, guys. I mean, he's got 17 points in 12 games since Brian Little went down with an injury. He has the most points over the last 4 weeks than any other player in the NHL, 19 points in his last 13 games. I mean, we saw how he played last night and how he's been on that 8-game point streak. I mean, it's been incredible. You got to give him a lot of credit, and I don't really think that you can really give him that much negative criticism. I mean, he has really responded, and if he's healthy, he easily gets 30 goals and 70 points, in my opinion. And, you know, he really continues to emerge as an excellent center in the NHL. Whether you want to call him a first-line center or a second-line center, he's been fantastic. And, you know, I think, especially with Little's absence in the lineup, Mark Scheifele has been really good. And does he have room to grow? Richie, absolutely. He can be harder on the puck, better defensively, better in the face-off circle. But as far as offense goes, I mean, this guy has just been on fire. You have to give him a lot of credit. And especially with Blake Wheeler, has slowed down a little bit over the last 3 or 4 weeks. And Mark Scheifele just continues to put up points on the board.
Well, to your point about Mark Scheifele, I saw a tweet earlier today from Ted Wyman of the Winnipeg Sun. He says, at the start of the season, Mark Scheifele told Ted that he wanted to be a 65-point player this year. His 0.79 points per game that he's averaging this season in the games, you know, take away the games he's missed and everything else, that would give him 64.8 points over if he had played all 82 games. So, you know, to your point and about Mark Scheifele, it sounds like he is sort of where he had hoped to be had he played an entire season here. Rich, you know, go talk about the how you see the Jets. You know, does this fill out the bottom six? Mark Scheifele, you know, piggybacking on Ezzie's points there.
Well, I don't know what you plan on talking about in the offseason if you want to break that down.
I don't want to break it down in extreme detail.
Let's avoid that topic now, because there's work to do in the offseason. But again, we said they're not as bad as their record indicates. So there are a few moves to me to make in the offseason to get them back to be very competitive,
sure,
but they don't need an entire facelift. I mean, they've, you know, retained basically all draft picks over the past 5 years and developing, you draft these guys so they come through the system. In terms of Scheifele, I mean, Scheifele's exceeded my expectations as a player. I said that a couple weeks ago on the show. I mean,
before the hat-trick game against Montreal, we praised him on Saturday's show.
Yeah, Drew, you know what? I mean, I expected him to be a second-line guy, second-line center from what I saw early in his career, and then, you know, maybe you're kind of like, if you're talking first line, you're talking like poor man's first line. Like, if you're considering Brian Little a first line, to me, he's a poor man's first line. Like, he's not going to be a top-end guy.
Sure.
Mark Scheifele's
not Crosby Malkin.
Right, or even, you know, the guys behind that. But you look at what Mark Scheifele's done, and he's taken his game to the next level. Now, everybody can say he's taken his game to the next level. The question you ask is, why is he taking his game to the next level? His skating is considerably better than it was when he came up through the ranks when he was 20 years old, and certainly when he has cups of coffee when he was 18 and 19. So he's skating a lot better, certainly more powerful, and he's gotten a lot stronger. With that strength has come a better shot. And that shot is becoming lethal. I mean, he's been able to shoot it off his back foot. If he's basically sitting on the right circle, if you're in the offensive zone, at the top of the circle, just flicking shots, and every shot he takes is a dangerous one. Mm-hmm. And he's scoring from there. He doesn't need much room. So if you think about, you know, how much he's improved, because he's always smart, and he always had a quick release, but his release is quick, and now it's powerful, and his skating is better, and he's stronger, and these things aren't, you know, are certainly related. All of them are related. And I think that's a testament, really, to his work ethic first and foremost. I mean, had he not gotten stronger and put his time in and stayed on the rink longer and all that, I don't go to practice very often. Very rarely am I there, but when I'm there, he's always on it late and practicing and working on his game. And if you think about it, what he's done is very much, to me, is a credit to him and certainly exceeded my expectations. So the Jets have to be extremely excited about him. And the way he's playing right now, if that translates to next season, the remainder of the season, then to next season when the chips are on the line again. And he played well before the chips were not on the line. So I'm not attributing it to the fact that they're out of the playoffs.
Sure.
It gives the Jets different options in the offseason.
Before we go to break, yeah. As he mentioned that he thought that Alex Burmistrov, you know, has proven enough to enter in as a where was that you that said about the Alex
Burmistrov
being a third line center?
Well, I think the question really, Drew, is he going to be a third line center or a fourth line center? I think a center is where he's better. So I think is he a third line center or is he a fourth line center? I think that's the question.
But you think he's better suited as a centerman than he is as a winger?
I personally do. Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah, I mean, I said it before. I think Burmistrov, it remains to be seen. He's better suited for a third line center or wing role. But again, it depends what the other line combinations are at this point.
Well,
I want to talk about a couple of just little lineup things from last night. So why don't we take a break and talk about that after?
We can do that. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. Minutes after the top of the hour, you're listening to NHL This Week here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by the 44th annual Rady JCC Sports Dinner featuring keynote speaker and Pro Football Hall of Famer Dan Marino. The dinner is coming up on Tuesday, June the 21st, and will also honor former Chicago Bears player and University of Manitoba Bison's product, Israel Adonijé. To purchase tickets, visit RadyJCC.com or call 204-477-7513 for more information. It's going to honor the past of Bison's football with Israel Adonijé and the future with David Onomata doing a hell of a performance in front of, what'd they say, 18 NFL teams yesterday at U of M?
It was 17 or 18. It's pretty incredible.
It is for a kid from the University of Manitoba. You know, anyways, it's great to see the Bison's football program churning out NFL talent. It's
for
a
sure.
great program. Brian Dobie, Vaughn Mitchell, the guys in charge of the program there, have been doing a great job for a number of years. Continuing on with our discussion of last night's game, some things you wanted to talk about, Rich, and of course we want to talk about them too. Jacob Trouba with Dustin Byfuglien out of the lineup last night. Jacob Trouba gets to play with Toby Enstrom. And, you know, how did you think Trouba handled the added minutes, handled the extra responsibility, sort of handled the, you know, the position without number 33 in the Jets lineup?
I found it fine. Just, you know, you talked earlier in the season about Trouba and kind of where he fits and all this, and I said I'd like to see him play with Enstrom, and it happened to be that, you know, Buffon's at the flu and he wasn't able to play, so Trouba gets a shot. But I like Trouba on the right side, guys, you know, watching more and more. That's where he creates the speed. That's where he creates a little bit of trouble for the opposing team in the neutral zone. Mm-hmm. And seeing him play with a guy like Enstrom who can play off of him, play with the puck, I thought, you know, it's something that piqued my interest for the future. And I know Byfuglien likely will probably expect him to be back tomorrow, so I'm not sure how long that experiment will last. But I do think that the Jets are playing like fairly well. I do still think that you have to use this time. You saw Paul Maurice switch the lines up in Detroit, that some experimentation wouldn't hurt here because you very rarely get that kind of time. And in the preseason, now with the World Cup next year, I expect it to be even less meaningful, and it's already not very meaningful. So maybe give some experiments to different combinations on the back end.
Ezzy, what do you think about Trouba's performance yesterday? How do you like him with Enstrom?
I thought Trouba was good last night. I think he's been pretty good over the last handful of games, and I think I wouldn't be surprised if you see Josh Morrissey come back into the lineup. I'm not saying that I have any inside knowledge here, but to Richie's point, I think when you're at this point in the season, you know that you're not going to be in the playoffs. It's a great opportunity for a guy like Julian Melchiori to get into the lineup. It's only his second NHL game, and for a Winnipeg Jets team who has struggled defensively, and right now they don't have Mark Stewart, and he's getting a little bit closer to coming back, but you have a significant weakness there on the left side. It has been all year. The Jets don't have a true shutdown defenseman. I think Tobias Enstrom on a good team is a third or fourth defenseman, and I think right now, even though he is a good offensive defenseman, I don't think he is able to perform in that left side first pairing shutdown role. I think when you play against teams like Chicago and St. Louis and LA, the elite teams of the Western Conference, throw Dallas in there, I think he really struggles. And, you know, I don't care if his plus minus is good. Plus minus is a flawed statistic. I think he really struggles down low. He's a smaller defenseman. So I still think going into the offseason, that's something that Kevin Cheveldayoff is going to have to address going forward. And Josh Morrissey, is he going to be a top pairing defenseman eventually? It's possible, but he still only has one game of NHL experience. So I think at this point, you're probably going to have him in a third pairing role heading into next year. But absolutely, I think, you know, Tyler Myers, I said it during the first segment, I thought that was one of his stronger games. But Tyler Myers, guys, is the Jets' best overall defenseman. Night in, night out, he is usually good, and he usually plays 24, 26 minutes. So I think the D pairings were pretty solid last night. They were on Saturday against Colorado as well with Buff in the lineup. So again, you know, it's nice to see Paul Postma get some ice time, because let's be honest, before the trade deadline, Paul Postma wasn't getting much ice time, and neither was Adam Partey. So for a guy like him who's been in the press box for most of the year, it's nice for him to get some ice time.
Well, you mentioned Paul Postman. You mentioned that the ice time, and there was this talk that, you know, when the season was obviously slipping away, that this is now an opportunity, another audition for Paul Postma. You know, have you seen anything in his game over the last, you know, last dozen games that has said to you that Paul Postma is a strong candidate to be a member of this defense and the future of this defense going forward?
I don't know about that, Drew. I mean, that's a little bit more intense, but I think what you're seeing now is a guy who's, you know, yesterday had about three pretty good to golden scoring opportunities. I know he didn't convert on them, and probably overthinking it a bit, but he gets them.
Sure.
And that's, you know, there's something to be said about being part of those chances and creating those chances. So you saw a little bit more confidence, I think, from him. I mean, he still makes, I think, some bad reads, you know, defensively in neutral zone and in his own zone. But you're seeing some, you know, what he brings to the table is his mobility and puck moving skills are assets to, you know, our strengths of his game. So I think it's interesting to see him get some time here. He's got to earn the trust of the coaching staff. I don't think he has it, or at least didn't have it until recently.
Yeah.
So with some opportunity here, maybe he's able to do that. But you have to wonder, and I think I was talking about with Rick when I was doing, I think, Detroit game, you know, the team has him on the 2-year contract. Mm-hmm. Do they think it differently than Paul Maurice thinks of the player? Or maybe are their views eventually going to align? So I don't know. I think it's good to see something different there. You know, I know Mark Stewart has many detractors, and his game is certainly different than Paul Postma. But you look at the Jets' back end with their mobility. If you basically have six mobile defensemen, it makes you difficult to defend. And although I do appreciate that the Jets aren't playing some of the best teams in the league right now, and when you do need to defend, to Ezzie's point, in your own end, and guys like an Enstrom and Morrissey on the left side, you do need to me, and we'll talk about the offseason in the offseason, sturdy up that with a little bit of bigger player, at least, to be able to defend. And if so, Tobias Enstrom is going to be on your top pairing. And again, you guys know I like Tobias Enstrom. I know he has his detractors as well, not to the extent that Mark Stewart does, but he has his detractors. I like Tobias Enstrom. But to Ezzie's point, and I agree with it, if you're going to have him playing your top four, which I think most certainly he is a top four defenseman, then you have to have a guy behind him able to handle a little bit more of the defensive load and allow him to play to his strengths, puck moving, skating. I think he makes good decisions for the most part, then always defending, and you saw that was a troublesome point last year in the first round against Anaheim.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll go out to Boca Raton, Florida, where we'll be joined by Jonas Siegel to talk about the general manager's meetings. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. It's 6:30 in the evening. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment is brought to you by Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys is known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want customized, visit Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program Jonas Siegel. Jonas is the national hockey writer for the Canadian Press. He joins us to discuss the NHL's general manager meetings. Jonas, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. Thanks.
Our pleasure to have you on, Jonas. Obviously, the NHL's GMs are meeting this week in Boca Raton, Florida, a nice place, of course, to hold meetings. And, you know, the topics of conversation, I don't think are anything unusual or anything that we find surprising. What's surprising to me is that the NHL has gone through, you know, 65, 70 games in this season, and only now have they determined that, you know, we should probably put a camera in the blue line if we're going to make the officials try and call these bang-bang millisecond offside plays. Was that an oversight from the NHL's perspective from the start of the year?
It might be a little bit of an oversight, but I think they wanted to see how this whole thing would work. You know, they wanted, and I still think this is their contention now, they still want to see what it looks like over a full season with playoffs, get a real sense of, you know, the problems with the coach's challenge, the successes of the coach's challenge. And I think just being able to go through it and seeing how difficult it was for the officials to make these calls, and, you know, even for the video coaches who have to determine, you know, whether to signal to their benches to challenge in the offside situation in particular, that they kind of had to go through this to get to the point where they could say, you know what, we can make this process better. Like anything you put in, any rule change, you're always going to need to see it and then see what needs to be fixed. And I think, you know, it's a good example with the coach's challenge. There are aspects of it, you know, that obviously have been a success. But then you look at, you know, the success rate in terms of plays that have been upheld and plays that have been overturned. It's like 75% upheld. So it's not like, you know, the officials are getting things drastically wrong. You know, they're just taking steps to kind of improve the process where they can.
Jonas, based on your conversations with GMs over the last couple of days in Florida, is there a lot of talk about possibly adding different types of plays that could be challenged?
That's a great question. That hasn't come up, and that has always been my, I don't know if fear is the right word, but we see it in other sports when you add replay, it's not the one thing that you add or the two things that you add. That's just the start, you know, and the blue line cameras is an addition. And, you know, that's where it gets a little bit dangerous because, you know, you can't be challenging and reviewing every single play. But given how subjective so many calls in the game are, where does it stop? Like, that's the part, you know, when you talk to some players and you ask them about the coach's challenge right now, one of the things they don't like, and I don't like, and I'm sure fans and other people don't like, is how much time it can take. It completely, in some situations, takes the flow route right out of a game because it takes 5-6 minutes in some instances to get a decision. So it hasn't come up, you know, what could be added to the menu, but I wouldn't be surprised as we go along here in the next few years if certain things come up that they say, you know what, why don't we add that to video review?
Jonas, in terms of goaltender equipment, you know, attention on that, so much has been made about this every year. For, I don't know, 10 to 15 years. I remember really since like Garth Snow was wearing those lacrosse style shoulder pads, JSG gear. Is there any reason to believe that this will actually have a serious, you know, effect on scoring?
I think it could, because this time it actually seems like it's a real change. Like they are going to trim, I guess, the pants and the upper body equipment to more match the size of the goaltender. So if you're, I don't know, a small guy, you can't be wearing equipment that is substantially bigger than you just to use it as an advantage. Whereas you look at some of the little tweaks they made, you know, a couple years ago they trimmed the pads a little bit. But this could be, you know, we didn't get a good look, obviously, at what the equipment will look like. But if it matches what they said, this should be a change. Now, what does that mean for scoring? I don't know. You know, we look at the goaltenders from the 80s. We look at, you know, how much different they look to the goalies we see now. They don't even look like they're playing the same position. So if you have smaller goaltenders, maybe scoring goes up. But then you look at the height and weight of some of the guys in the position now, they're all so much bigger anyway. You know, they're all pretty much 6'2". And beyond, like I was even looking up Jonathan Quick. I just was curious today to see how big he is. He's 6'2", or listed at 6'2". So I'm not sure. You know, I think that's part of the intention. They said that is not the reason that they made the change in terms of you know, reducing the size of the equipment. They said they made the change because it was something that the goaltenders wanted, that they wanted the position to be more about skill and less about, you know, how big your equipment was and how much that helped you in terms of blocking. But clearly, you know, based on some of the other things that they discussed today, they are trying to figure out ways to increase scoring. That's something that, you know, I think will continue to be an issue heading into the summer at the next meetings.
You're listening to NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Jonas Siegel. Jonas is the national hockey writer for the Canadian Press. Jonas, Rule 48 was discussed today at the NHL General Managers meetings. Maybe a tweak to the rule regarding illegal checks to the head. In the end, it sounds like there was no action taken by the general managers. Is that what you expected? Or are you surprised that, you know, some of the hits where a player is vulnerable but not really going to be in an impactful spot? Are you surprised that the GMs didn't try and sort of crack down on those hits?
No, I wasn't really surprised because I think that the rule has, I don't know if it served its purpose is the right way to put it, but I think it's, like, go back a few years ago. You guys remember, it seemed like every other night, and at that time I was covering the Leafs and I was at every single game, and I remember just being on the road and being in an arena somewhere and, you know, you'd get word of a hit, a blindside hit. And it seemed like every other night there was a play in question and there was a suspension. And then we had this talk in the media and, you know, everywhere else. What should the suspension be? Brendan Shanahan was making videos. Like, it just seemed like it was a constant thing. And I think at least this rule has kind of curbed that a little bit. That was one of the points that Steve Yzerman made today, that you don't see those hits quite as much where you have a player coming out across the middle and getting blindsided like you did before. So I think they probably looked at, you know, what the rule was intended to do and saw that it was having the intended effect of curbing those types of hits, maybe changing the mindset of players a little bit, though it is a really fast game. But I wasn't so surprised that they looked at it and concluded that it didn't need much change. But saying that, you know, it was just one group of general managers that kind of studied that issue. They were broken up into three groups, and there was one group that looked at Rule 48 and looked at boarding, and they ultimately said that they didn't think anything needed to be changed.
Jonas, you mentioned that the coach's challenge was the most prominent topic at the GM's meetings. You also tweeted out yesterday that one of the other things that was being discussed, aside from the expansion draft and talking to, I believe, Lawrence Gilman was involved with that. The other thing you were talking about was the All-Star game and how a lot of the GMs liked the new All-Star format that saw three-on-three, groups of three-on-three. Was there any discussion about possibly changing the All-Star voting process?
That was a question I meant to ask and never got to ask, especially in light of everything that, you know what happens at these things? There's just like, they open their doors and there's just these swirl of GMs that are popping out left and right. You're just like darting from one to another, asking as many things as you can and trying to cover as much ground as you can. But in light of everything that happened this year with John Scott, with the NHL, you know, seemingly doing what it could to keep John Scott out of the All-Star game, I have to believe, and maybe I'll try to get to it tomorrow, though tomorrow's going to be a really busy day because they're going to talk about that expansion draft. They're going to talk about the draft lottery, but maybe that's something to get to tomorrow. But I can't believe for a second that the NHL is not going to put something in place. I don't know what it is to prevent that from happening because it was an embarrassment. You know, it's not fair to John Scott to kind of put him in that position. It doesn't look good on the league. I don't know what rule they'll come up with, but I think tomorrow is going to be such an interesting day because I think, you know, once whatever details come out about, you know, a potential expansion draft, I think teams and fans are suddenly going to be looking at their rosters and saying, well, how is this going to work? So I think that's a really interesting point. But the All-Star game, certainly, you know, they're going to have to do something about that.
Jonas, have you considered maybe wanting to caddy for any of the general managers? And that's a good way you can
exactly
keep them, you know, nice and close by in case these questions pop up.
I am not a golf fan, so I don't think I could stay. I don't like playing for 18 holes, let alone caddying, so no.
If you look at, you know, Jonas, you talk about expansion. What is the talk out there? I mean, I guess the GMs are more concerned about a possible draft and less incentivized by the fact that these owners are going to make a bunch of money off that. Is
right.
Does their opinion really matter?
Great question. I think that is the tug and pull that's probably going on right now, because owners will look at it and say, you know what, you can get $500 million U.S. split amongst the teams in terms of expansion fees, and the GMs are looking at it like it's a little bit more complicated than that. We've built these teams to manage, or we've managed these teams under a cap. We've accumulated prospects. We've accumulated good contracts. And now all of a sudden, you know, some of that work could be undone. I don't know what you do to make it fair, and I'm not sure anything they can do to actually make the process fair to GMs who have owners who will want that money. So I'm not sure what they're going to do, but if you go back to 2000, when they added two teams then, the restrictions were there were two scenarios in terms of how many forwards you could keep, how many goaltenders, how many defensemen. But now it's just so different with the cap. Like, that's what I'm really fascinated by, and why I'm not sure how it's going to work, because contracts matter. You know, what does this mean for prospects? Like, how is this thing going to shake out in a situation with the cap where everything is so much more detail-oriented? I'm not sure what's to come tomorrow for that.
Jonas Siegel is the national hockey writer for the Canadian Press. He joins us from Boca Raton, Florida, where the general managers of the NHL have been gathering. Jonas, really appreciate your time this evening. We'll let you get back to the socializing, and I'm sure we'll read some of your great articles in tomorrow's newspaper.
Thanks, boys. Appreciate it.
Take care, Jonas. Thanks very much, buddy. Let's head to break. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN 1290. Big thanks to Jonas Siegel from the Canadian Press for joining us to talk about the NHL GM meetings. We'll continue that conversation now. First, though, this segment brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. Those GMs really work hard at these meetings. My favorite line, it comes from our buddy Frank Saravelli's article yesterday, talking about, he's in Boca Raton, of course, Monday's meeting lasted just 2.5 hours as GMs were urged to socialize, golf, and fish to casually discuss the game. No kidding. I thought they were going to be in that boardroom sweating out the details for an entire 8-hour day in Boca Raton, Florida. Anyways, gentlemen, the general managers meetings.
Hold on. I mean, I think that there's a point to that, Drew. I agree with you. I mean, I think they're out by, meeting was adjourned, I think, 12 or 12:30. Yeah. People, like, I mean, TSN Sportsnet sent probably combined as many GMs as there are there. It's like, you know, it's 30 people sent down and there's 30 people they're covering. And I bet you many of these GMs don't give as much thought to these things that you might think. Like, you'd be surprised, in my opinion.
Well, they're probably too busy running their, I mean.
Well, yeah, and, you know, and a lot of times, and then they're, you know, yeah, I mean.
Well, there's a reason why they're always, you know, a few weeks after the trade deadline, when this is a bit of a quiet time for general managers.
Sure, I just don't think, I think this is a little bit, not a little bit, this is pretty media overblown, these meetings.
Sure, well, they need something to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, there's hockey's getting, picking up here, there's races. I'm not, don't get me wrong, we're going to discuss it, but I don't think this is something, you know, article after article after media type. I just think that the level of thought put into it and the significance is, I don't think it's, they're on equal footing there.
The media blows it a bit out of proportion, is what you're saying. Okay.
Well, so spend another 20 minutes talking about it.
Okay. Well, we're nothing if not thorough, right? Yes. So anyways, the talk, we'll start with what there was discussed yesterday at the meeting, which is, you know, the coach's challenge and everything else. You know, obviously the coach's challenge is here to stay. I didn't like it when they introduced it. I don't like it, you know, today. The fact that it took him this long to realize you need to put a camera at the blue line to catch offside plays is what boggles my mind more than anything. And we've talked about it before on the show. Yeah. I mean, also the goaltender interference, it's impossible. You say it's goaltender interference. I say it's not. It's too subjective to really be subject to video review in my mind, but they're going to try and go with it, and they're going to go with it, and it's going to cost some sort of team in the playoffs, and then we're really going to talk about it.
I think when it comes to goaltender interference and offside calls, the two major calls that are reviewed. I think the issue is centralizing the review process in Toronto for me, because I think that there is going to be some subjectivity to the calls. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's whether or not you want to centralize it like you do when you review goals. After every goal is scored, it's reviewed in Toronto. So I think that, for me, that is going to be something to look at. And I agree, Drew. I think, you know, they go to Florida, they golf. There's a reason why they do it in Florida, right? But I think that's, to me, probably the best thing to come out of this. I think the goaltending equipment being reduced was something that we all know that was coming, and that's something that has been done time and time again. So that's not a surprise to me. And, you know, as far as the expansion draft goes, we know expansion is coming. We know Vegas is getting a team, so it's something that they need to talk about. Doesn't necessarily mean Vegas is getting a team next year,
yeah.
But it's something that they have to do their due diligence, right? And so that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that that's on the docket either. So when you look at what is going to come out of this, I think it's healthy discussion, right? It's not only healthy discussion for those guys, but it's healthy discussion for the media, and just kind of gets people thinking about the game in a different way. Because I agree with you, the NHL Coaches Challenge is not going anywhere. And it's really at the point right now in its infancy, so they have to really fine-tune it, right? So I think that's what's happening. They're trying to find ways to make it more effective. I think we've seen a lot of goals with the MTS Center that even after it was reviewed, it still looked like they got the call wrong.
Sure.
I don't remember which game it was, but there was an offside call. It looked like it was offside, but you couldn't really tell because a player was blocking the player that went offside.
And then there was the 40-minute delay in the Washington game in overtime, however many months ago.
But Drew, is a blue line camera really going to solve that? I mean, there's still going to be subjectivity involved.
I think I think it would be stupid to introduce the offside as a challengeable call from the start. Goaltender interference, I'm okay if you want to look at that on camera, but offside, I have trouble believing that a player being a millimeter onside or offside makes a world of difference.
Well, another thing, guys, is how long these reviews are taking.
Sure.
I mean, I know you guys are bigger baseball fans than I am, and that's something that many people believe is ruining the game. Some of these challenges are taking too long, and I forget which GM addressed this. It might have been Lou Lamoriello. It could have been someone else. I forget. But they were saying, well, take as long as you need to get the call right. But the problem is, for the hockey fan who's sitting there for 10 minutes waiting for, you know, the referee to view the replay on a little tablet, I mean, they got to find a way to make it quicker.
The other problem is that the home teams don't show the replays to the crowd that are going to adversely affect their interests. So if you're sitting at a game for 10 minutes and your team scored a goal and it's been challenged, they don't show the fans.
Yeah, which is an edict from the NHL, because I think the NFL does the same thing.
They usually don't do that. Over penalties, you see the same thing.
Sure.
I think in reality, I mean, I don't... I think this is something that's, like, again, a bit of a media creation overall. I think if you're going to be reviewing things, I think there's a... I personally am not big on the offside. If you're going to do it, finally, I don't have a big position on it. I'm not too passionate about it. But the offside, one of my issues with the offside is that that's happening at the blue line. Like, and I know it's kind of brought in because of Matt Duchene's obvious offside call that happened because
the
national brought it back
in.
But, I mean, if you're going to beat two defensemen, that's different to me. What this should be reviewed is goaltender interference, fine. If you're going to do that, fine. So do goaltender interference, do high sticking to confirm the stick actually hits the face, and it's not the wrong stick, which sometimes happens, and do puck over the glass and put a camera right on the glass. And that one, puck over the glass. Those three seem to me to be, because high sticking, it's simple. It's not subjective. Does it hit the face or not?
Sure.
The puck over the glass. Does it hit the glass or not? And then goalie interference, again, you're getting into the subject. I'd like to keep it to the ones which are very easy to tell, or easy based on compared to the other ones.
Yeah.
Those I'm fine with. And then offside, it's so tight, and you have to beat other players. I just, if I had my way, I'd probably keep it to those two.
I don't disagree with you on those. I mean, I think that makes perfect sense.
And then goals over the line, of course, but that's been replayed for, 20 years now?
Yeah, about that. The thing I'm interested in seeing, if it actually does come to fruition, is Kay Whitmore's project with regard to goalie equipment. If he is able to successfully shrink the goaltending equipment, I think that will have an impact on scoring going forward. Big if, though.
If you, again... Do I agree with you? Yeah, if it's actually implemented. How many times have we've been on the air for years now?
Tons.
What, 7, 8 years? How many more times are we going to hear about the NHL, shrinking the goaltender equipment? It's like an annual article.
Well, it's not only how much are we going to be hearing about it. The NHL has been reducing goalie equipment now for well over 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you. I think that that's something that you should always be looking at, Richie. But I really don't think it's going to have a huge impact on goal scoring. I mean, we've talked about it. There's other things that you can do to increase goal scoring in the NHL. I've actually argued that I actually don't think it's a big problem. I mean, I look at Patrick Kane is going to easily hit 100 points here. I think the goal scoring is up a little bit since last year. Last year, obviously, there was no player that hit 90 points. This year, there's probably going to be three or four that hit 90 points.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't think it's a huge problem. You got to look at other things. I mean, we've talked about it, guys, a lot. It's probably coaching that kills goal scoring the most.
Sure.
Coaches wanting to go into that defensive trap type of mode,
suck
whatever
the
you
offense
want to call
out
it,
of the game.
Left wing lock, whatever you want to call it. I mean, coaches, and it's a strategy. I mean, coaches are playing to win the games however they can, right? They usually like to win games 3-2 as opposed to 6-5.
Uh-huh.
Fans like the 6-5 games, but 3-2 games, put it this way, as soon as the first round of the playoffs start, is anybody complaining about that? No.
You know, another topic I'm interested in, you know, all the praise for the All-Star weekend. You know, that we've been hearing, well, the general manager has been Boca Raton.
This is such a boring meeting. I can't believe these boring topics have created so much attention.
The
useless All-Star game and the John Scott stuff. Who cares?
Well, like, and the thing about the useless All-Star game, what a great format. What a great format. It wasn't a great format. They happened to be in a great city.
Oh, I don't mind the format based on other stuff. Drew, it's the All-Star game. Like,
sure.
None of the players want to go to the All-Star game. The NBA, it's an event because all the players want to go and be seen. Mm-hmm. NHL, no one cares. Well, so can you make the players care? And how do you you make the players care by paying them $90,000 to win?
No, you make them care by the. I mean, the NBA All-Star game is always in big cities. It's always in Los Angeles. So it never goes that many years without being in Los Angeles or New York, Toronto this year, you know, Atlanta.
I don't care what city. It's the All-Star. We're talking about the All-Star game equipment for the 100th time.
Well, the players like to go because it's a party. That's the only reason why
the
NHL...
NBA, it's a party. Yeah.
The only reason why the NHL players liked it this year is because it was a huge party. They went to Nashville. Next year, they'll be in Los Angeles, so it'll be a good party. The first year, it's back in, Edmonton. Or Minnesota, or I mean Winnipeg for that matter. You think these guys are going to want to come to Winnipeg in February? I mean, I live here. They're not going to want to come to Winnipeg in February.
And they fell backwards into this being any kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
So it was such a great success.
I know.
Okay, we talked enough about the All-Star game in January. Let's start talking about the playoff races here.
Rule 48, last one that's on the topic. Are you surprised that they didn't tweak anything about Rule 48 with regard to hits to the head and, you know, making the check that, you know, Anton Strahlman delivered on Brian Little, a penalty, or, you know, trying to get that out of the game?
I thought Dalton Prout should have gotten 3 or 4 games for that.
He got one game earlier today
for sucker punching
Kucherov.
I thought that was, I mean, I realize he has no history of suspension. I actually like Dalton Prout's game, but that was a dirty play. I mean, he punched a guy who didn't see it coming. And if you're going to get hard on shots to the head, I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that. I mean, I'm not surprised, Drew, because I think what they were talking about was potentially giving a guy a penalty, maybe even ejecting him for a hit to the head that wasn't intentional, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that then you get into a slippery slope type of situation where, you know, if the player moves his head and it's not intentional. I mean, I think they're actually I'm going to say this on the record. I think the NHL has done a really good job with hits to the head. I think the suspensions maybe sometimes are a little bit too lenient, but I think for the most part they're doing a good job.
They are too lenient. I mean, you know, that's why it's not surprising, as you said, that there's no tweaking. They're too lenient on the hits to the head. They're too lenient on hits from behind. And it's not really a surprise. I mean, even we're going to talk next segment about the hit to Donnie Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
That's 10 games. The guy's out for the year. He's a linesman. That's 10 games.
Yeah, not used to getting hit.
So, well, not expecting to get hit either, which is the bigger thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I'm just going to stay what I said at the beginning of the segment. This is media created, and thinking more about it, had any Canadian team been anywhere near the playoffs this week, we would not have as much attention. But because all the Canadian teams are done and they're out of it, resources go to another story. I don't think there's many stories here.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Dennis Weidman, Don Henderson story with Joshua Smith, the managing editor of ScoutingTheRefs.com. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. Hour two of NHL This Week here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. This segment brought to you by the Riverview Health Center Foundation, Cycle on Life. Join IC on June the 5th in raising money for the Riverview Health Center's Alzheimer's and Dementia Awards by cycling in the event or contributing to Team Illegal Curve. For more information about the Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life or to join Team Illegal Curve, visit rhcf.mb.ca or send us a tweet at Illegal Curve and we'll get you all the relevant information.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the program Joshua Smith. Josh is the managing editor of ScoutingTheRefs.com. He joins us to discuss the Dennis Weidman, Don Henderson issue and the arbitrator's recent ruling that cut the suspension in half. Josh, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be on, Drew.
Our pleasure to have you on, Josh. Obviously, I mentioned the reason we're having you on, as this has been a significant topic of conversation throughout the hockey world since the incident happened, I guess about 6 weeks ago or so now, given a length of time since it occurred. How surprised were you when on Friday, the arbitrator James Oldham came out and cut the suspension in half from 20 games to 10 games for Dennis Weidman?
I was surprised. I was pretty disappointed, actually. The NHL, I thought, did a good job standing by their officials and taking that hard stance with the 20-game suspension. You look at the initial ruling that came down and treated it as intent to injure. Bettman reiterated the same thing, kept it at 20 games. So it was pretty disappointing to see that the outside arbitrator would cut that in half and really undercut the NHL's decision, which personally I thought was the correct one to make.
Josh, the fact that the decision, this 20-game suspension, was reduced to 10 games after Dennis Weidman had already served 19 games, the fact that it's reduced because of the fact that he didn't intend to injure Don Henderson, what kind of message do you think that sends to the other referees, not only in the NHL, but at all levels of hockey?
Well, I think it's a tough situation here, because I think at the NHL level, there can be a lot of disappointment in the arbitrator's decision. But I think that the NHL officials understand that the league as a whole did stand by that 20-game suspension and stood by their officials. So I don't think the NHL referees and linesmen will really look negatively on the league as much as the arbitrator, and the fact that this was handled by an outside arbitrator really took it out of the league's hands. I think the dangerous part of the message is what it sends to players at other levels, where they're seeing that maybe it's not taken as seriously or maybe it's not as big of a deal, and there's enough abuse going on with officials at lower levels, verbally, occasionally physically, where we've seen recently some parents physically confronting officials after the game. And I think this certainly doesn't help the case of showing fans, parents, coaches to respect officials. So I think the bigger impact and the one that concerns me most is that at lower levels, they're seeing a reduction in what was a pretty serious offense.
Carey Fraser talked about the fact that almost he'd rather have been spit on if he was in that situation that Donnie Henderson was in. And he wrote it on TSN about the fact that, based on the rule interpretation and the minimum suspensions, that would have been his preference as opposed to Henderson, who's now dealing with a concussion. How does this change? How does the officiating community, I think kind of probably a joint effort, maybe with the NHL or with the PA as well, how do they change to ensure that this doesn't happen again?
I think that's the big question, is cracking down on it. Like I said, when you've given up the responsibility for making the ultimate decision, and I know the league has inferred that they might look to challenge the arbitrator's decision, which per the CBA is the binding and final decision. But I think when you've lost control of the ultimate decision, it's pretty tough to come back and find a way to battle that. I think the perception of it is the hardest part, because thankfully these incidents don't happen frequently. And I think this was a great time to put a stake in the ground and say, you know, we're going to take a hard line stance, and we're going to show you that officials are off limits and we won't tolerate this. But you did get a slightly different message from the arbitrator. And I think whether it's intent, and a lot of his decision was based on whether it was intent or not, I think everybody can agree that it was a violent hit, and the optics of it just aren't good to see that in any context and say, I'm going to reduce the suspension on this. But I think it's nice to see all the officiating organizations, the NBA refs, the NFL refs, all release statements to support the NHL officials, because I think we realize the officiating community as a whole needs to really fight for that respect and try to demand that leagues take it seriously. So the bigger question for me is how the lower level leagues can address it, and that they remain aggressive with any instances of official abuse and be sure to take it seriously.
Josh, I may be off base here. I was talking to somebody the other day, and you know, they were taking issue with kind of the inconsistency of the officiating that they see in the National Hockey League, and I brought up the point that nowadays nobody knows the officials' names, nobody knows the referees or the linesmen, and there's no connection. So to me, when I was growing up, the idea that a certain referee was reffing a game, I had an idea of how he would call a game, and then my expectations were shaped around what that guy's reputation was. So if you call a lot of penalties, then you expected to see a lot of penalties because you knew the referee. Is that lack of personal connection between the public and the officials, you know, a part of the reason maybe that the public doesn't seem to be as much outcry over somebody like Donnie Henderson, who probably nobody knew before this happened?
I do think that's a big part on all sides. I think from fans, I think even from players who, based on some of the things I read, I know Greg Wyshynski did a player survey, I think prior to the season, about their favorite referees, and a bunch of the players they spoke to could only come up with a handful of officials' names. So I think from the players on down and to the fans, you lose a little bit of the personal part. And I think the biggest part is that having a number and not a name can be dehumanizing. And I think you start to treat the officials that way when you don't connect that there's a person behind that number. And that is, that's not just linesman 93. That's your person that's there. That's the guy with family. It's the guy with kids. That's somebody who's working on the game and trying to do the best they can, just like the players out there. So, yeah, I think personally, taking the names off, while it may have given the appearance that the NHL officials are just one cohesive unit and that they're interchangeable, I do think it removed a lot of the humanity from the officials, and I think that's probably made it easier to challenge. And you might not be able to yell that referee's name when you're screaming at him from the stands, but I don't think the insults got any quieter.
Do you think the referees would trade that off, the insults from the fans, which frankly many of the older refs became used to, for the personal relationships that, not only maybe with the fans to an extent, but to your point about, you know, with the players and coaches?
I think the ones that I've talked to, and I certainly haven't talked to all, but at multiple levels where they've seen the same things, I've heard the majority of guys who would prefer to have their names back. They're getting the insult either way. People are screaming at them one way or the other. But when you've got your name on the back and you can tie that to a person, or you can remember that's a person, I think that's a trade that I would make just to bring that piece of it back and bring more to me as an official than just black and white stripes and a number on the back.
Yeah, we hear the ref you suck chants. I might as well go back to, you know, have another hot dog, you fat pig.
Sure.
Back in the Jim Schoenfeld days from back, the last big incident between the NHL and its officials. You're listening to NHL This Week here on TSN 1290. Our guest is Josh Smith, the managing editor of ScoutingTheRefs.com. Josh, I'm on your website right now, and on your website you have a statement from NHL referee Dan O'Halloran, easy for me to say, president of the NHL Officials Association, and the last line in his statement is what I want to ask you about. It says, quote, the NHLOA intends to take all steps necessary so that its members are protected in the future and ensure that this type of conduct by a player, Dennis Weidman in this incident, against an official never happens again. what steps do you think the NHL OA will be able to take to, you know, make that statement come to fruition?
From an official standpoint, it's hard to say. Obviously, you want to open ongoing discussions between the NHL OA and the players and the Players Association around what you can do. But you look at where they're at from a framework standpoint, and the players have their CBA, which entitles them to certain things, including the arbitrator taking over decisions like this. The NHL OA recently signed, prior to last season, their CBA with the league for the next 5 years. Historically, I don't see a whole lot of appetite for anyone to renegotiate an existing CBA when it's been in place. So short of putting in a sweeping, behind-the-scenes policy change like that, I think the best thing they can hope for is to just have those ongoing discussions and try to find some way to make sure that the officials are respected and that they're understanding that, this is not an approach we want to take. This is not an example we want to set. And maybe that's the best way to twist players' arms is let them know and remind them what kind of an example they're setting for all of the other leagues out there. These are the pros. Everybody's watching them. Everybody's reporting on them. Everybody's modeling them, whether it's good behavior or whether it's a hit from behind on an unsuspecting linesman. And I think that's probably the biggest impact they can have. But as far as a direct consequence, I'm not sure what can happen outside of the existing construct.
Josh, the NHL announced this week that they're going to add blue line cameras. I'm sure that you've read about this. They're going to add them for the playoffs. Do you think this is something that's going to be a good tool for the referees, or do you think this is just going to benefit the coaches?
I think, when you ask, the whole goal is you're not going to get every call right, but you want to get the call right. And if there are tools that can help get the right call made, I think it's something that the officials would be in favor of. Having another camera angle to look at is going to give them another chance or another opportunity to see that play from the right angle. I know there's been some concern around with coaches challenged with goals being overturned or goaltender interference being overturned. The whole point of that is to give the referees a chance to see the game with a replay, see it from a different angle, and assess whether the call at judgment in the case of goaltender interference or a little bit more objective when it comes to offsides, but to give them that other angle so that they can see the play and take a second look at it. So I think it's a good thing to have the cameras in place as far as the coach's challenge that already exists. So why not give them as many tools as they can to get the right call made?
Josh Smith is the managing editor of ScoutingTheRefs.com. Josh, really appreciate your time and insight today into the world of reffing and the world and the incident between Dennis Wideman and Donnie Henderson. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Glad to join, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Josh. Let's head to break. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN 1290. Big thanks to Josh Smith of ScoutingTheRefs.com for joining us to talk about the Dennis Wideman, Don Henderson incident. Before him, we were joined by Jonas Siegel of the Canadian Press. In case you missed either of those interviews, they will be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and of course on our website, IllegalCurve.com. This segment is brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy, always wear a mouth guard, and give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information about the Linden Market Dental Center, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. Funny how that works out there. Anyways, gentlemen, looking at the Calder Trophy race, most people have it between Artemi Panarin and Connor McDavid. And right now, of course, Panarin does have a significant edge in points, given that he's got 62 points in 68 games played. McDavid, only having played 35 games due to the collarbone injury, has more points per game. He's up to over a point per game now with 36 points in 35 games played. Is this Panarin's award still to lose? is McDavid the only competition he has, or could you see, you know, a guy like Shane Gostisbehere, if he is able to get the Flyers into the playoffs? He's, I mean, he's at 38 points in 49 games. Does he deserve to be in the conversation as well, or is this just a two-man race between McDavid and Panarin?
I mean, we know McDavid's the best player in the group, but he hasn't played enough of the season to me.
Sure.
I mean, if I'm looking at who's the leading candidate, it's Panarin. He's been so good and so good with Patrick Kane. But your point, Drew, if the Flyers get into the playoffs and Gostisbehere puts up, say, 45 points in 60-some games and scores, what's the stat that I read this weekend? He's, I think all of his goals have either been game-tying or game or giving the
like,
team the lead.
Was he have six overtime winners or something like
that? Yeah, I don't know if it was Frank Saravalli or Larry Brooks, whoever it was. I mean, his numbers are incredible on a team that really needs defensemen. So I think he has, if he continues this pace, he's got to work his way into the discussion. Think about it. 45 or so points for a defenseman versus 70 points for a forward. One playing with Patrick Kane, the other playing with obviously some talented forwards, but not a lot of good defensemen. I think it's still up for grabs, actually.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rich. I think when you look at Connor McDavid, for me, he's not one of the finalists because he just missed too many games. Mm-hmm. The Calder Trophy isn't an award for who's the best player of the rookie class, because Connor McDavid is the best player of the rookie class.
Yes.
Who's had the best season, right? So I think Shane Gostisbehere has been in the discussion for quite a long time now. I think it's just a question of, is he a finalist or does he finish fourth or fifth in voting? And if you remember last year, guys, with Johnny Gaudreau and Mark Stone and Aaron Ekblad, it was one of the closest races we've seen in a really long time. And I think this year, with Connor McDavid and Jack Eichel and Dylan Larkin and Panarin and Gostisbehere and some other good rookies, Sam Reinhart, you could throw in there. I think this is probably the best rookie race we've seen since Crosby, Ovechkin, and then maybe Taves, Kane, Backstrom, the year that they were 1-2-3. If you remember, Taves and Kane both had the same rookie year. So I think that right now, if I was picking my three finalists, Connor McDavid wouldn't be in there. Just, again, and it's nothing against the way he's played. It's just he hasn't played enough, and I don't think it's fair to the other players. I agree with Rich. Panarin is the favorite, and sure, he's been playing with Patrick Kane. And
do you dock him at all for the fact that he's been playing with Patrick Kane?
No. No. He came into the NHL as a 24-year-old, and he's been really good throughout the year. He hasn't just gone through streaks. He's been consistently good throughout the year. He's been really good, and he's got the most points. So I think we'd all agree that he's one of the finalists. For me, Gostisbehere is one of the finalists. To Richie's point, I think for a 22-year-old defenseman to do what he's done with all the goals and the points and playing those top minutes with the Philadelphia Flyers in a variety of situations, I think he's a finalist. And I'm kind of on the fence. The next one is Dylan Larkin or Jack Eichel. I'm not sure who I would pick. I mean, I think Dylan Larkin has probably been more consistent, and he's playing on the top line there of Detroit. And Jack Eichel right now is second in points amongst rookies. So to me, the third one's probably Eichel or Larkin. But if Connor McDavid is healthy, I think we'd all agree that he easily, well, not easily, but I think he would probably,
he might win the Art Ross Trophy.
Well, I mean, point a game right now, he's 1.03 points a game. So he might end up with 85 or 90 points if he's healthy. And if he ends up with 85 or 90 points on an Edmonton team that's not making the playoffs, I think it's hard to not pick Connor McDavid as the winner of the Calder Trophy. So again, I think it's one of the best races we've seen in a long time, and that's the best thing about the NHL these days. There seems to be these great Calder races every year. I mean, next year, you're going to have potentially Austin Matthews in there. You're going to have Dylan Strome and Mitch Marner from the 2015 draft class. Mm-hmm. You might throw in Puljujarvi or Matthew Tkachuk. I mean, year after year, there's going to be great Calder races, and I wouldn't be surprised if this one is just as close as it was last year.
Do you penalize Rich Panarin for the fact that he's doing this at the age of 24 when he's fully matured, whereas the other guys are doing it when they're, you know, 18 years old?
It's a fair argument, and certainly it's an advantage for him having played pro for longer, but the rule doesn't state that that's a factor.
Sure.
So if it doesn't say that's a factor, the writers ought not, I think the writers choose to Calder, ought not to have that be an affect their selection. I just think that if that's the rule is how it is, that's a rookie definition, then you're a fair game. Look at baseball. When the guys came over from Japan, and it was Ichiro 26-27 when he came and won.
He
the
won the MVP and the, I think, and the rookie of the year the same year.
So that's the rule. That's the rule. Gostisbehere, back to him for a second, Drew. And has fifth in the league in terms of defensemen for points per game. It's only behind Carlson, Letang, Burns, and Klingberg. Like, that's pretty impressive. And as he talked about, you know, the ice time and such, that's pretty impressive. And if you think about it, you know, in regards to that ice time, all of those guys are playing 22 plus minutes. Carlson's playing 29. Gostisbehere is 19 and a half.
And I said this last week, Richie, as far as the Philadelphia Flyers making the playoffs and the impact that would have on Gostisbehere getting the Calder nod, I don't think it should have any effect on that. I think Dave Haxtell's done an awesome job. If Philadelphia ends up finishing 2 points out of the playoffs, for example, I still think Dave Haxtell should be nominated for the Jack Adams Award. He won't be because that's just something that happens. If you, a coach really is rarely, I can't remember recently a coach ever being nominated for the Jack Adams when his team misses the playoffs. Same thing goes for the Calder Trophy. It usually is a player that has the most points. But I do think that Gostisbehere deserves to be one of the finalists. And even if he isn't, I mean, he's still going to be considered one of the top rookies of this year's class.
Sure. Along those same lines, you talk about the playoffs and everything else. Are we giving short shrift to Jack Eichel's season? I mean, second in rookie scoring. He's got 48 points. It's, you know, so happens, of course, it's on a Buffalo team that's not going anywhere this year. But are we giving short shrift to him and to Max Domi, given that, you know, both of those teams aren't going to be playoff bound? They've been playing out the string now for the last, you know, 15, 20 games in some cases. But those guys are putting up, you know, impressive numbers for a rookie. I mean, it wasn't that long ago where a rookie won the Calder Trophy getting 50 points.
I thought Eichel would be better.
So really?
I've been holding that against him. I thought he'd be better. I mean, all you hear about is Eichel McDavid. McDavid has 36 and 35, and Eichel has 48 and 70. That's a huge difference. I mean, that's 1.03 points per game versus 0.69. Now, Eichel still had a very good year, Drew. And as obviously we know that, he's an incredible skater, great shot. He's going to be great. He already is a very good player. I certainly see Etsy's point from him being next ahead of Larkin. And I think that argument certainly has validity to it based on a number of factors. Talk about where he's been. Now, he's had a lot of success recently on the line with Evander Kane and Reinhardt. But based on, you know, not playing on a great team, new environment there in terms of coaches and systems and stuff. And obviously for him anyways, everything's new.
Mm-hmm.
Still lacking on the back end and needing the help to get the puck up front. You know, that's what Connor McDavid deals with. You wonder how these guys would perform if they had defensemen who can actually get them the puck. More than one or two. So those are factors. I think actually Larkin kind of has that problem too, because Detroit's defense maybe is not as good as it once was,
sure. But
still better than the other two teams' defense. So I think he benefits from that. And Larkin, he's slowed down a little bit here too. And while he plays less minutes than Eichel, I'm not going to hold that against Eichel.
Ez, what about it, Eichel? Do you think he's been? Are you slightly disappointed like Richard is in his season, or do you think that he's been pretty much what the Sabres could hope for?
Well, no, I earlier said I would probably pick Eichel as one of the finalists. It's between Eichel and Larkin for me, so I don't think he isn't deserving, as he maybe not put up as many points. I didn't really have a projection for him for points. I mean, when I've watched him play, he's been very good, and he's a rookie, and he's only going to get better. As far as Max Domi goes, I think the only reason why he maybe doesn't land in the top three is because he's slowed down since the beginning of the season. If you remember, Max Domi and Anthony Duclair really came out on fire, and they've slowed down a little bit. But that's not to take anything away from Max Domi. I mean, he's going up against Jack Eichel, Dylan Larkin, Shane Gostisbehere, Panarin, McDavid. I mean, it's a really good rookie class. I mean, we haven't even talked about Nikolaj Ehlers, who is top 10 in rookie scoring.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't miss all of this time, he probably ends up with 40 or 45 points, right? He's at 31 points now. So it's a really good rookie class. So that's not to take anything away from Max Domi or Jack Eichel. They've also had great years, and they're going to be a big part of their team's future in the years to come.
When we come back, we will discuss Stanley Cup favorites facing some adversity. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN 1290. You're tuned to TSN 1290. This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Reminder, Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show, 9 a.m. on this fine radio station. We'll look back at Friday night's Jets-Blackhawks game and get you set for Sunday afternoon's Jets-Ducks game. Nice to see some the Jets after, you know, Vancouver and Calgary earlier in the week stepping up in weight class, of course, against the Blackhawks and the Ducks, two elite teams in the league. This segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. I can tell you, gentlemen, a special concert series comedian announcement coming tomorrow. So be sure to stay tuned to rumorscomedyclub.com. Follow them on Twitter. There is going to be a big comedy announcement coming down tomorrow. So you can check that out and look forward to that. Speaking of the Chicago Blackhawks, as they enter here into Winnipeg later on this week, they're currently struggling 4-5-1 in their last 10 games, humiliated on home ice last night by the Los Angeles Kings, a 5-0 defeat at the hands of the Kings. And then, you know, are you worried at all about the Chicago Blackhawks? Are you concerned that they might be more vulnerable this year than they are last year?
Not really. I mean, this is kind of the same story, right? You know, not playing great until they really need to. Mm-hmm. I mean, even last year, the Blackhawks, frankly, I didn't think even played particularly well until the playoffs. Right, they could have got lost in the first round, and then they got momentum out of that. I said here, Drew, a couple weeks ago, I think the only thing that concerns me about the Blackhawks is that fourth defense spot.
Sure.
And how they're able to defend in big games down the stretch. You know, third periods when you're loading up against Kopitar and Carter's lines continually, stuff like that, if they make it that far, Sagan and Spezza. Otherwise, I don't have a concern. I think this is kind of a lull in the season. And you heard Washington, you know, we're going to talk about Washington, but you heard guys, I remember when Washington played Chicago a couple weeks back, watched the game, it was a very good game.
Mm-hmm.
But you heard guys, you know, from Washington say they were excited to play a game like that that had some meaning because they locked in the spot so early.
They'd had so many games that were just going through the motion. I mean, it's the flip side of
exactly.
the
Great.
Teams
exactly.
that are in the playoffs.
I was just
going
to say that. The you teams know. Like the Jets have been out of it for so long.
Sure.
It's the same thing. They've been in it for so long, and we know the result.
It's hard to get yeah. play it at the same 100% capacity. And they always say, well, you can't just turn it on before the you know when the playoffs start. Time and time again, we sort of do see teams that almost flip that switch.
I don't know if they flip the switch from 0 to 60. They might flip it from 40 to 60.
Sure.
That's the thing. So, I mean, the Capitals have played excellent hockey this year. They will revert back to that. Now, last year, I think the Blackhawks were a bit of an exception. But, yeah, I mean, that is a little bit different. But overall, I think you have to get to that level at some point during the year and then get back to it. You can't just go from nothing to something. Like the Blackhawks, you know, the Blackhawks didn't win 20 games to get into the playoffs like the Colorado Rockies did 10 whatever years ago and then somehow make it in. Like, it wasn't like that. They were still a playoff team.
Go ahead.
Sorry. And, I mean, you get pushed at times, but it wasn't as if there were some point way out of it, mm-hmm. like Minnesota, I think, was last year, and then they make a huge run.
Sure.
The Ottawa. real, yeah, exactly. The real contenders, they flip it a bit.
Right. You know, there's an interesting article as, you know, on TSN.ca. Travis Yost looks into the Blackhawks numbers, you know, if you have an analytical bent, and mm-hmm. he says, and here's a quote from it. If you knew that the Blackhawks were currently playing at a 105-point regular season pace, you'd likely guess that they'd be breaking pretty favorably in pure 5-on-5 goal differential. But that's actually not the case. Mm-hmm. At even strength, the Blackhawks have scored 109 and conceded 109. If you're curious about who sits right behind them, it's Ottawa, who's got a minus three goals against differential. So what Travis Yost is saying that the Blackhawks 5-on-5 haven't actually been that good this season. They're really getting tremendous goaltending from Corey Crawford, and their special teams has been clicking at, quote, an insane rate. Only Washington is scoring more goals per 60 minutes on the power play than the Chicago Blackhawks.
Well, they have a lot of skill, though. It's like looking at the Jets. The Jets have been pretty good at 5-on-5, really good at 5-on-5 and terrible at special teams.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is.
You play in all aspects of the game.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason Washington and Chicago were good on power play. They have an incredible amount of talent.
Sure. Ezzy, you have any concerns about the Blackhawks as we enter the final 15 games or so of the regular season here?
I don't have that many concerns. I think it's going to be very difficult to repeat as Stanley Cup champions. Mm-hmm. You just don't see that very often. You know, you mentioned the advanced stats, Drew. The Hawks right now are 14th in the league in Team Corsi, as we know, that's been a determinant to a certain degree of who wins the Stanley Cup. The Hawks were either first or second in the last couple of seasons, and then 3 years ago were first when they won the Stanley Cup in 2013. The last four Cup winners were either first or second in the league in Team Corsi. Now, whoever is the leader in Team Corsi doesn't necessarily determine who wins the Stanley Cup, but there are some troubling signs. The Chicago Blackhawks have not been good in the Central Division this year, 11-10-2. The Blackhawks are 17-14-4 on the road. They haven't been good on the road. They've been one of the better home teams in the NHL. I think they're second in the NHL to the Washington Capitals. The Hawks don't have trouble scoring goals. The Hawks are second in the NHL in offense to the Washington Capitals. Corey Crawford is arguably a Vezina Trophy finalist this year. He's got seven shutouts. He's got the best numbers of his career. So the goaltending is not the issue. Richie mentions the D depth. I would agree that that is something that should be a concern for Joel Quenneville and his coaching staff. If you look at what Joel Quenneville's done the last couple of games, he's actually put Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews together. And that's not something that you've seen much this season, and that's because they only have 10 goals in their last five games. They've been struggling a little bit as of late. This team is not going to have trouble scoring goals going into the playoffs. When you match up against certain teams, you're still probably deeper than most teams in the NHL. The Chicago Blackhawks still have the best defenseman in the NHL, in my opinion, in Duncan Keith. Toews, Kane, and Hossa are still three of the most dominant forwards in the NHL. The Blackhawks are only 3 points behind the Dallas Stars right now for the division lead. So it's not like the Chicago Blackhawks can't still win the division. They've been struggling a little bit here. They've only won four of their last 10. They've always struggled, it seems, at some point in a season when they've won the Stanley Cup three of the last 6 years. So I wouldn't be too concerned. I still don't think the Chicago Blackhawks, though, are the favorite coming out of the Western Conference. I think there are other teams that are hungrier. But, again, when you consider the experience, the talent, the coaching, it's tough to not pick them, right? Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be that concerned. Again, I don't know if I would put all of my money on the Chicago Blackhawks to win the Stanley Cup this year, because I think there are some teams in the East that are a little bit sick of the Western Conference teams winning the Stanley Cup every year. I would put the Washington Capitals at the top of that list in the East. And there's some other teams, too, that I think are looking pretty scary. But you're also looking at a couple teams in their own division right now that I think have something to prove. St. Louis and Dallas have been watching the Chicago Blackhawks dominate that division year after year, and I think they're going to give them a good run for their money.
Well, you mentioned a team out of the East, and the Washington Capitals have been the class of the Eastern Conference all season. They're also going through sort of a middling period, 5-4-1 in their last 10. They last played on Saturday night against the San Jose Sharks, where they lost 5-2. Frank Saravelli in his Monday must-read column on TSN.ca talked about the Capitals, and this is sort of the first adversity they faced all season. The Capitals, quote, have now played 310 minutes and 26 seconds of hockey without a lead. Alex Ovechkin has just one goal in his last eight games. He's been held scoreless in five straight for the first time since early last season. Vezina Trophy favorite Braden Holtby has perhaps shown some signs of fatigue with a .911 save percentage since February 4th. Pardon me. Here's Barry Trotz to the Washington Post. Quote, everybody that we're playing is in playoff mode. They're fighting for playoff position. They're marking us, using us as a little bit of a yardstick based on our record, so every game is hard. You've got to fight for inches. Right now we've got some guys that are playing hard, but we're not fighting for enough inches. You're going to have to fight for the inches in the playoffs, and you've got to prepare that way and expect that. I mean, Barry Trotz knows the situation. He's telling this to his players. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, they're 18 points up on second place in the division.
Yeah.
They're 17 points up on the second place team in the conference. That's so far ahead. Their goal differential is plus 59. They're on cruise control here. Mm-hmm. They're completely not motivated. And if you want to bring up another thing we could talk about in NHL is when the teams are that into the playoffs, the fact that all they're getting out of this is one extra home game in a seven-game series.
It's not a huge advantage.
Like, it's not. You're seeing the NBA now a ton, like all these guys being rested. I mean, if I'm Barry Trotz, what I'm doing now is I'm putting players on schedules. I usually don't like that, and I schedule, I mean getting them scheduled rest.
Sure.
And I usually don't like that because guys go to games for the first time and they pay big money to see these players.
Fans you're talking about.
Yeah, and I know some teams have a policy of doing it more so on road games because they cater to their own fans.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even be averse to – I certainly wouldn't be averse to doing it for Washington home games only because you know you're going to be playing in the playoffs for a few games and a little bit more of an extended run. So I think what Washington needs to do now is focus on rest. And then I think I wouldn't be as concerned about the way they're playing as I would on rest. And I'd rather, if I'm managing the squad, for example, I'd rather play, have these guys rested and ready to go for that last week and a half of the season, and then get them playing together again to make sure everybody's on full, you know, riding high, as opposed to playing them hard, resting them for a week before the playoffs.
Sure, let them get some, get their legs back under them in time for the playoffs to begin. What do you think about that strategy, Ez?
Richie, nobody should be concerned about the Capitals right now because if they win tonight, they clinch a playoff spot.
Yeah,
it's March,
crazy.
It's March 15th, and they can already clinch a playoff spot. They're going to end up with probably 120 points.
Mm-hmm.
This is the best offense in the NHL. Has Braden Holtby struggled a little bit? Yes, he's got 41 wins this year. And it's March 15th. He's going to win the Vezina.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Ovechkin has the most goals in the NHL. Has he struggled a little bit? What are they playing for right now? They've already won the division. They're going to win the President's Trophy. I mean, if you should be concerned if you're playing the Capitals in the first round of the playoffs. But as far as, you know, some of these struggles, I mean, Ryan Getzlaff struggled earlier in the season. Corey Perry struggled earlier in the season. Sidney Crosby struggled earlier in the season. All these guys were named to the Canadian World Cup roster.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, guys struggle. So I wouldn't be surprised. I know Richie picked the Capitals to win the Cup before the playoffs. I didn't. But right now, heading into the playoffs, if you ask me who I think is the most well-rounded, dangerous team, it would be Washington. And is there maybe a little bit too much pressure on them? And has Barry Trotz never won a Stanley Cup? Sure. But if you watch that team play, no team plays better 5-on-5, in my opinion, than the Washington Capitals. Picking up guys like Justin Williams and TJ Oshie already made them better. Kuznetsov is leading the team in points, and he's leading the team in points with guys like Ovechkin and Backstrom on the team. So this team is still a force to be reckoned with. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go 16-0 in the playoffs, but just because they've struggled a little bit here shouldn't make anybody worry too much. I think the coaching staff might be worried that maybe they're slipping a little bit and they're getting a little bit too complacent because they've already locked up the Metropolitan Division. But I wouldn't be surprised if they won tonight, and I wouldn't be surprised if they finished the season strong.
And Ovechkin right now is ailing a little bit.
Yeah.
So you get him, like, you know, talking about the rest, Holtby's overworked as far as I'm concerned. So there's things like...
Yeah, so, you know, Richie, they play Grubauer a little bit down the stretch.
That's right.
You know, the last couple of games, maybe Holtby doesn't play. I wouldn't be too concerned about this. You're talking about a guy who played 73 regular season games last year, right? And we talked about the wins, 41 wins. I mean, you know, Ben Bishop, Corey Crawford, Corey Schneider, Roberto Luongo. There's some other goalies that might have something to say, but when you look at those win totals, I think it's going to be tough not to give the Vezina to Holtby.
By the way, and I don't really want to touch on it, I just wanted to bring it up. Nobody at all is talking about the Boston Bruins.
Well, I was just going to mention earlier, guys, we talked about, you know, Bill Peters, possibly coach of the year, Dave Hextall. I mean, Claude Julien, is he the favorite now?
Nobody's talking about
the
Boston Bruins.
And finished second in the conference. Is he the favorite with that defense?
Gerard Gallant's in there, too.
He's in there, too. Yeah. Although they're fading right now.
Yeah, they're fading a little bit. But, I mean, I just can't. I mean, people look at the standings and, whoa, when did Boston get up that high? I mean, that's a team that is, you know, Tuukka Rask, he can steal you. He can steal you more than games. He can steal you series. And they might not even to steal series, just win the series because they're going to be the favorites.
They could win the division too. Right now, that division, I think it's a 3-way tie.
They're a point up.
Yeah, so they're a point up. Anybody can take that division. Yeah. That division is not very good. It's been a very bad division this year. The Metropolitan Division is stronger with the Caps, the Islanders, the Rangers, mm-hmm. Flyers, Penguins. But, I mean, yeah, you got to give them credit, Drew. I don't think any of us picked the Bruins to make the playoffs this year. That defense is not as good as it used to be, but they're still very strong up the middle with Bergeron and Krejci. And they're very solid in net, as you mentioned, with Tuukka Rask. So you got to give them a lot of credit. And nobody is talking about them. Maybe more people should be talking about them.
I mean, we've talked about this over the weeks here. It's better for the league, Rangers, Islanders first round, and Florida, Tampa first round.
Sure.
And that's better for the league, creating the rivalries that people want to take an interest in. Even Anaheim, San Jose would be, or LA, San Jose, I think, would even be better in that first round. And you look at it, the Rangers, Islanders are I can say they're locked in just yet, but we know they're not catching Washington, obviously. Yeah,
Pittsburgh would have to go on a run.
Yeah, Pittsburgh would have to go on a run here, and you're seeing some interesting first-round matchups, and we're going to talk, I guess, about the Canadian, the fact there's no Canadian teams, how that affects the cap, and the lack of interest. It'd be helpful, you know, for hockey fans to have some good rivalries to focus on in the first round.
Let's hit the break. When we come back, we will talk about the Canadian teams, the lack of playoffs, and the impact on the salary cap. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. As he does each and every show, Bruce Springsteen brings us back for our final segment.
You're the boss.
You're listening to NHL This Week on
Bruce,
TS.
Drew, not you.
You know this song, Drew? Let's go back to this. Yeah. Do you know this song?
Yes, it's Rosalita.
That's good.
Thank you.
And so he sang this at the concert I just saw. But this song is like one of the most impossible songs to sing along with him. So he threw it to the crowd at one point and just pulled it back. And to understand, it was in Florida. There's a ton of New Yorkers and people from New Jersey. And if they can't sing it, then
nobody's
going to
sing
it.
Let Bruce do the honors then, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich, located in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. So, of course, we know that the NHL will be without Canadian teams for the playoffs this season. What we don't yet know is exactly how significant that impact is going to be on next year's salary cap. Tim Warnsby on CBC.ca, a very interesting article about the effects that the lack of Canadian teams in the playoffs is going to have on hockey-related revenue, which is what makes up the salary cap. And if the NHLPA, and it's still, each and every year, the NHLPA has the option of using a 5% escalator, where they can just boost the salary cap by 5%. They've never not used it. But there is talk this year that they will not use it because of the impact it has on escrow, meaning the portion of the salaries that are withheld from each and every paycheck.
Okay, Drew, it's too late to talk escrow.
Sorry. If the NHLPA chooses not to use...
Escrow.
Chooses not to use the 5% escalator, and then there's no home playoff dates in Canada, which is a huge impact on the NHL's bottom line. You're going to be
especially for merchandise sales, as Tim points out.
Merchandise sales, ticket sales, where ticket prices are jacked up for the playoffs.
In Montreal, where you have 22,000 seats.
That's right. Toronto never has playoffs, so we don't really have to worry about that.
Yeah.
But the impact is not. I mean, we've talked about the TV ratings and that aspect of it, but the impact on the actual dollars and cents of the salary cap going forward next year is still yet to be figured out, and it's going to be a significant one on the 30 NHL teams.
Well, the craziest part is Dave Schultz in the Globe and Mail reported that MLSC, this is, you mentioned, without the Leafs making the playoffs ever, the MLSC earns about $100 million a year in profit.
Only.
Like net profit, I believe.
Yeah, and Richie, the Oilers have missed the playoffs for 10 straight years, and the Leafs have missed the playoffs for 9 of the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim Warnsby mentions this in the article. You look at how many home playoff dates there were, Drew. 19 home playoff dates in 2015, 14 of those in the first round, because you had Vancouver and Calgary.
Calgary, sure.
Right, so you had Winnipeg getting swept, but then Calgary advanced.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that series only went to 5 games, right?
That's right,
against them.
Four home games. Them and the Habs, right? That's what it was.
It'll affect the salary cap a little bit, but I think really right now the low dollar is probably having the most impact on the salary cap not rising. And you have, the TV deals are in place. That's not changing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's unfortunate. This is the first time since, 1969-70 that there hasn't been a Canadian team in the playoffs. Last year we had 5.
Sure.
Right? So this year you have none. I picked 2 teams to make it this year. I had Calgary. Not Vancouver. Sorry, Vancouver. I had Calgary and Montreal making it. I didn't pick Winnipeg to make it, unfortunately, but that's because of how good the division
is. You made the right call. What do you mean?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm always pulling for
I picked them to make it.
That's true.
I made the wrong call.
Needless to say, Richie, I think we all had Montreal in there. So we all probably had 2 or 3 Canadian teams making it. So it's unfortunate. As far as the salary cap goes, Drew, it's unfortunate because right now, it's the most unfortunate for the GMs. You know, talking about the NHL GM meetings earlier with Jonas Siegel, these GMs just they can't find enough money to sign more players. I mean, you don't think Stan Bowman would want the salary cap to go up to $76-77 million?
Well, if they don't use that 5% escalator, I mean, that's the point of this all. I mean, each and every year you can budget. Okay, it's 71.4 this year. 5% escalator, that's another, you know, let's say $3.5 million, give or take. All of a sudden you're up to, you know, $75 million of a salary cap. If the NHLPA, I mean, you know, $3.5 million is a second line player. It's a third line player. That's somebody you're going to have to take off your roster. And these general managers won't know, you know, in, at least for another probably 6 weeks or, you know, 8 weeks until they have a firm idea of what the salary cap is going to be heading into the 2016-17 season. It's going to really affect a lot of teams. And now it doesn't affect them all. You know, we saw it 2 years ago with Johnny Boychuk and Nick Leddy being dealt from Chicago and Boston, respectively, right before the season started. Because that's really, you can go, what, 10% over the salary cap?
In the offseason.
In the offseason. Yeah. And so that's, you know, by that September, whatever date it is, that's really when, you know, you're going to see a lot of teams are going to be desperate to get under a salary cap.
It's also, you know, you look at it and you think to yourself, well, Gary Bettman has so much of his focus on the American markets.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like you need to focus on the Canadian markets here to really boost the game up.
Sure.
Financially, at least. I think I saw it somewhere. Might have been on the maybe the Toronto Sports Media blog there. The writer, I don't remember which one when it was, had the point that the league actually, you know, they talk about Austin Matthews being...
It was actually Gary's column. It was Gary's article saying that, you know, the Arizona Coyotes would the league would benefit from the Coyotes getting Austin Matthews.
And I see his point because he's an Arizona boy, 100%.
Sure. But it was Jonas on the Toronto Sports Media website, the one you're talking about, who says it's the Leafs who need the boost. It's the Canadian teams who need the boost, not Arizona in this instance.
It's interesting. You know, I could certainly see both sides there. But you look at it and you wonder, some of those American teams probably want these Canadian teams to do well. Why? Because you just mentioned Stan Bowman has more money to spend.
Sure.
And Richie, it definitely sucks that there aren't going to be any Canadian teams in the playoffs. It sucks for Canadian hockey fans. It sucks for NHL as far as revenues go. But I really do think this is going to be an aberration. Look at Edmonton with Connor McDavid. I think if he's healthy, they actually have a legitimate shot at making the playoffs. Not saying that they would make the playoffs, but sure. You look at some of the teams. Winnipeg has a lot of good young talent. Vancouver has a lot of good young talent with Vertanen and McCann and players like that. And then you look at Toronto. They might end up getting Austin Matthews and Steven Stamkos, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I wouldn't expect this to be the norm. Again, would any of us be surprised if three or four Canadian teams make it next year? I wouldn't.
Only point I'll say to end, you know, we got to end the show here, is that Winnipeg fans cared a lot more about other Canadian teams being in the playoffs before the Jets came back.
It's true. You're very right about that. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, Riverview Health Center's Foundation, Riverview Health Center Foundation Cycle on Life, Keener Jerseys, and the Rady JCC Sports Dinner. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com. For producer Eric, for Richard Pollock, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. And until Saturday at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck. And thanks for listening to NHL This Week with Illegal Curve Hockey.